Well, any questions about anything from last time?
Last time I showed you Thayer's theorem, which is a beautiful thing.
Let's see, we've been writing the partial sum of a Fourier series, Sn of z. There's two ways to write that. One is as a trigonometric polynomial. Where the an's and the bn's are the Fourier series coefficients. And a fancier way and complex way to write this as a sum as n goes from minus n to capital N of cn e to the inx. They're completely equivalent, and those are the nth partial sum of the Fourier series. And the Thayer's theorem had to do with taking the Chisaro means of those Fourier series. So the Chisaro means, they were sigma nx. You add up the first n Fourier approximations. So let's see, the zeroth one is just a constant. And to get n of those, the last one would be s sub n minus 1 of x, and you average them. And the bizarre thing about this, when we wrote it out and analyzed it, was that the Thayer kernel that pops up, this was an integral from minus pi to pi, of the Thayer kernel of t times f of x minus t dt. That thing right there is the Thayer kernel, and we analyzed it. It had those properties of a good kernel, in fact, a very good kernel. I guess I didn't draw a graph of it last time, and so I think I should do that now. It's a nice thing to look at. Remember, it was not negative, so it had this. It had a gigantic value at the origin where it got huge, but then it goes like this and gets really small out here as I get to pi. So it goes to zero outside of any, that's supposed to look symmetric. Oops, that doesn't look symmetric at all. But I guess I should try harder. Oh darn. Let's see, it's going to be gigantic here. And go like that. That's kind of symmetric. So it has zeros, but it never gets negative. These spots are zeros. And the interesting thing is that the area under that curve is equal to 1. And it's positive. So that this area here is going to be 1. And it's gigantic right here. So that means the area, it's going to 0 outside a delta interval, and this area here would be, its still area would be 1. So this part's hardly contributing any. It means the area is getting concentrated at the origin. And that's exactly what makes a good kernel do what it's supposed to do. The Dirichlet kernel had this area equal one thing, but it had some negative areas because it wiggled below the axis. And in fact, the total area, if it had the positive and negative area, would go to infinity. And so that's what made it a delicate thing. But now I want to show you what the Thayer theorem was. Was that the Cesaro means go to F uniformly. If F is 2 pi periodic and continuous. That's a fantastic theorem. So to get the same thing for Fourier series, we needed more than just continuity. We needed that Lipschitz condition to make that happen. And now I want to show you, I realized after talking to you and looking at Stein's book, is that Thayer's theorem implies that Weierstrass theorem I told you about polynomials being dense in the continuous functions. So here's a fun fact. Thayer's implies Weierstrass's theorem. Weierstrass was a similar thing, except using polynomials in place of Fourier series. So let's see why. Let's suppose we've got a continuous function on the interval AB. Suppose F is continuous on AB. Make a linear change of variables so that the interval becomes minus pi to pi. That's an easy little thing to do. So make a linear change of variables so that F is defined on is continuous on minus pi to pi. Okay, I want to use Thayer's theorem, but this F, it's continuous, but it might not be periodic. So let's say it looks like this. Here's minus pi. Here's pi. F is continuous, so maybe it goes like this. No, I don't want to do that. How about it goes like this? I don't like that either. How about it goes like this? So it's obviously not continuous. What's my problem? I want to extend it as a periodic function, so I can use Thayer's. And here, if I extend it as a periodic function, I couldn't make it hook up, because these don't match. So here's the trick. I want to approximate by a polynomial. Well, I can subtract off this linear function that starts here and goes here. So this is my function is this blue one, and this red thing I'm going to call a linear function. So I'm going to subtract off that linear function, and that'll make my function zero at minus pi and pi. So the trick is to replace F by F minus L so that it's zero at minus pi and pi. F of minus pi equals F of pi, both are zero. And now I can extend it as a periodic 2 pi periodic function, and it's continuous. So extend extend F as a continuous 2 pi periodic function on the whole real line.
Now, Thayer's theorem tells me I can find a trigonometric polynomial that's as close as I want.
So let's let epsilon be bigger than 0. Thayer's implies there exists a trigonometric polynomial. Let's call it Pn, such that f minus Pn is less than, say, epsilon over 2 on minus pi to pi.
These things are periodic, so that if it holds on minus pi to pi, it holds on it on the whole real line. But we only care about minus pi to pi. And now here's the thing to realize. We want to approximate by polynomials. And we've got these trigonometric polynomials. I can always approximate cosine and sine functions by polynomials. That's what you learn in power series.
So the aha moment here is the trig functions, cosine theta, can be approximated by a polynomial, 1 minus theta squared over 2 factorial plus, I guess I'm using t, but what the heck, theta 4, etc. That's an equality. And so I can approximate these, and this converges uniformly on arbitrarily large intervals.
That was something you showed in the homework last week for complex things. And so this is just the real part of a complex thing. If the complex thing converges uniformly, then this converges uniformly on arbitrarily big sets.
So uniformly, convergence on big intervals, but in particular, uniform convergence on minus pi to pi. And similarly, sine of theta is theta minus theta cubed over 3 factorial plus blah, blah, blah. And the same thing.
And so I can approximate the terms in the in this Taylor series, in this trig polynomial, by polynomials.
So get polynomial approximations for the terms in the trig polynomial.
And I made it less than epsilon over 2 on purpose, so because I'd get a polynomial,
I guess I called that trig polynomial P, I get a polynomial, a genuine polynomial, I'll call it script P sub P, with Pn minus the trig polynomial minus the real polynomial less than epsilon over 2. Then my estimate, my uniform estimate would be F minus my real polynomial. That would be f minus my trig polynomial plus my trig polynomial minus this real polynomial. And that would be less than or equal to the sum of those things by the triangle inequality. And that's epsilon over 2 plus epsilon over 2.
So I approximated my original function with an actual polynomial. So now we know Weierstrass's theorem, and Thayer's theorem spits it right out. Questions about that? Another fantastic thing that Thayer's theorem gives us is that Bessel's inequality is an equality. And so you've got to remember what Bessel's inequality was all about. Bessel's inequality
is an equality for trig functions, for Fourier series. And let me remind you what Bessel's inequality was all about. Remember, we had phi n's orthogonal. In fact, they satisfied this condition. You inner product phi n with phi m, and you get 0 if n is unequal to m. And phi n inner product with itself is 1. This is orthogonal, and this is called orthonormal. We've normalized them so those norms were 1. To do that for trig functions, let's see, we would have, let's think about it. If I do this for trig functions, I'd have an e to the I n t paired with e to the I n t. That would be the integral from minus pi to pi of e to the I n t, and this would be the e to the int conjugate when you're dealing with complex functions. And that these things are just 1 when you multiply them together. This one would be e to the int times e to the minus int, and that's 1. So this integral is just 2 pi. This thing is the norm of phi n squared, the L2 norm of phi n squared. And so if I want to make this thing have norm 1, I should divide by the square root of 2 pi. So the fact is, one over the square root of 2 pi e to the int, or x, are orthonormal. And remember what Bessel's inequality was all about. So here's what I did when I did Bessel's. I wrote f, and it would correspond to a summation of cn phi n. And the cn's were the Fourier coefficients. And remember, they were given by f interproducted with the phi n. And Bessel's, what did I do to get Bessel's inequality? I wrote out the norm of f minus the sum out to n. That stands for the L2 integral. So that would be the integral of f minus this squared. And I played around with that and used orthogonality and just wrote it all out and got that this was equal to the L2 norm of squared of f minus the summation of cn squared. And that's clearly bigger than or equal to 0. Right, it's bigger than or equal to 0, so when I put the cn on the other side, the sum of the cn's is less or equal to f squared. But the next thing I did
is I messed around and put in different coefficients than the CMs and realized, aha, this is the absolute minimum.
So this was called, I called this E star. And then E was equal to, if I had a different trig polynomial besides the Fourier series trig polynomial, so these are not the Fourier coefficients, possibly not. Not the Fourier coefficients.
Then what I showed was that this E was strictly bigger than that E star.
So Fourier series are the best L2 approximate. That was the philosophy. Fourier series approximate the best in L2 square integral functions. And so that what that meant was that E star, that this E star area was strictly, was less than the E area, E error.
And in fact, the only way it would be equal is if you take these ANs to be the CNs.
With equality. Exactly when all the CNs equal the ANs.
Up to capital N. Well, now think about it. We've got Fayer's theorem. And Fayer's theorem says there is a trig polynomial, and I can make this E as small as I want. Okay? If I can make this E as small as I want, then my E star is also going to be small. And that's going to show me my Bessel's inequality is actually going to zero.
So that's the exciting thing. So the aha thing. Fayer's, so let's let epsilon be bigger than zero. Let's not mess around with epsilon. I'll say it in words instead. Fayer's implies I can find a trig polynomial I don't know what order it is, but Pn, such that F minus Pn is as small as I want. Let's say epsilon.
Then that L2 norm would be, I could make that L2 smart thing as small as I want.
Then, the L2 norm of F minus Pn squared, that would be the integral from minus pi to pi of F minus Pn squared dx. That's less than epsilon squared. And so this thing would be less than epsilon squared times 2 pi.
And so that shows me that my E star
is less than or equal to E is less than epsilon squared times 2 pi.
Let's see. You got to think about what trig polynomial. This Pn is a trig polynomial. And so I can think of some of those coefficients as being zero. Did I say there's no summation of Pn there? What I claim is that this is true. I should put n's here.
Let me put m I didn't put ends, did I? I'm going to go back and put ends. This is a trig polynomial of order n. This would be of order n.
So this is some trig polynomial of order n. But I can think of this as being coefficients that go out even farther, that have zero coefficients.
So what I'm claiming is that I'll call this, there's a trig polynomial of order n naught, such that that's small. And here, I've got an n naught. And here, I can put anything bigger than n. For n bigger than n naught.
So n naught is the order of this trig polynomial. And if, what I'm thinking of here when I do this is that I'm letting all the a_n's be zero until I get out to capital N. So this is a trig polynomial in that allowed group out to big N. It's just that a bunch of them I've chosen to be zero. And it turns out that that makes the estimate here even worse. And so this error is smaller than that error. And I made it arbitrarily small.
What we conclude is that the ENs have to go to zero. So we conclude the EN stars go to zero as N goes to infinity. And what that means is that the norm of F squared minus the summation of the CN squared equals zero when I go out to infinity.
And that's Parseval's equality.
Identity. This thing right here is called Parseval's identity.
And it happens whenever your system of orthogonal functions is complete. And that's exactly what we have here. And here's an exciting thing to think about now. Look at this thing. The L2 norm squared is this thing. That looks like the length in Rn. In Rn, this would be the length squared if you went out to n. But this is a Hilbert space, and we're going out to infinity. So what we can think of, because of this, we've got F in L2 is going to be equal to its Fourier series. And we're going to think of these things as coordinates. And the norm of F L2 norm is going to be, that's the integral of F, let's see, what is it? That's going to be the square root of the integral from minus pi to pi of f squared dx. And that's going to be the square root of the sum of those cn squareds. That feels like a length. That's the length of this vector. And it's very much like an Rn length. It's just an infinite dimensional Rn.
So this is going to be a length. Of a vector. And see, another thing we could show if we wanted to is if I take the inner product of two functions like this, that would be the integral from minus pi to pi. If they're real, there'd be no conjugate here, but if they're complex, there'd be a conjugate right there. That turns out to be the summation of cn bn conjugate, just like the inner product. Where the cn's are the coordinates for f, and the g, and the bn's are the coordinates for g. So this would be the f-coordinates, and these would be the g-coordinates.
So even from the point of view of inner products, this feels like Rn. The only difference is it goes from 1 to infinity instead of 1 to n.
Just like Rn.
Well, it's Fayer's theorem that gives you this Parseval's equality. It's also Fayer's theorem that gives you this.
I don't think I'll prove that part, but it's very similar.
Questions about that?
It's good stuff. I thought I'd go back and mess around doing a little bit more
historical problems that where Fourier series come up.
I want to solve the steady state heat equation on a disk. So the steady state means that time has gone on a long while and things have stabilized and are no longer changing with respect to time. So the steady state heat problem on a disk. Let's make it the unit disk. So we have our unit disk. Make it have radius 1. And I'll have a temperature function. And the temperature function, the heat equation is du dt equal a constant times the Laplacian of u.
And if a thing has reached steady state,
du dt would be 0. So at steady state, this thing goes away at steady state. So the heat equation becomes, see, this is the, think of this as a metal plate. And so the problem is, Laplacian U, the temperature, is identically 0.
And we want to know the temperature on the actual boundary.
And so that's the PDE. And the initial condition is the temperature of at radius 1, it's natural to do this in polar coordinates, the temperature at radius 1 is something given. So this is a given. And that is called a boundary condition.
That's the heat problem, the steady state heat problem. This is a famous problem called the Dirichlet problem. We solved the Dirichlet problem on a square earlier in the semester.
And this is going to be the Dirichlet problem for the disk. So this problem right here is called the Dirichlet problem for the disk.
There's actually some boundary conditions that are kind of hidden in this problem, and I'll show you where they pop up in a minute. So we're going back to the Bernoulli days, where you look for solutions that are special. We're going to look for solutions that are
of a special form. I'm going to do it in polar coordinates. So I'm going to write a function of r times a function of theta. There, you may have never seen a capital theta.
There it is. Capital theta of theta. Looks like an O with an H in it. Let's see, if I'm going to look for polar solutions, I have to write the Laplace equation in polar form.
This is, I gave you an exercise to come up with this change of variables. The Laplacian of u in polar coordinates is one is d2u dr squared d plus 1 over r du dr plus 1 over r squared d to u d theta squared. In cylindrical coordinates, in the Cartesian coordinates, this is du dx dx and du dy dy.
And if you do change the variables formula and chain rule and turn these derivatives to r and theta, that's what you get.
Okay, so in polar coordinates, let's see, my derivative of u there is going to be
dtu u dr squared. Those r derivatives will pile onto the r function.
So the PDE, when I plug it in, is going to be r double prime of r, and the theta function just sits there. And then my next one will be 1 over r. The du dr, that would just pile on to r, and the theta function just sits there. Then the last one is 1 over r squared, and this time the derivatives would pile on to the theta, because they're theta derivatives, theta double prime of theta. And I want that to be 0.
Well, that looks a little bit more forbidding than what we had when we were doing the vibrating string. But I can pull it apart. Let's see, how do I pull it apart? I'd pull this one over to the right. Then I divide by theta of theta. That would make the thetas get off this side. And I divide by r of r. That would make the r's get off this side. So I'd have all thetas on this side and all r's on that side. Let's see, I've got this annoying r squared, so I've got to multiply through by it. So that's the plan. So let's see, when I multiply by r squared, I'm going to get r squared r double prime capital theta plus r prime theta. And I'm going to put the other stuff on the other side. That would give me minus r theta double prime. And now I'm going to divide by r. That'll put all the r's over here. And I'm going to divide by theta. And that'll put all the thetas over there.
So the next step is divide by r. Then n theta, capital theta. And now I'm getting somewhere. Now I got all the r functions on the left and all the theta functions on the right. R squared r double prime plus r prime over r equals minus theta double prime over theta.
And once again, I've got a function of one variable trying to be equal to a function of a different variable.
Of course, the only way that's possible if these are both constants.
Lambda. And now here's the secret boundary conditions I didn't think about in the beginning. So
here I'm kind of stumped about what's going to make me have certain values of lambda. And I've got u of r theta is r of r times theta of theta. And this is a circle, a disk.
So if theta of theta goes around 2 pi and comes back, if it were to be something different, that would be like ripping apart the function. It would have a discontinuity. And so when I look at it like that, there's a hidden boundary condition.
It's called periodic boundary condition. Hidden boundary condition. I need theta of 0 to be equal to 2 pi, theta of 2 pi. Why don't I make it minus pi to pi? That feels better. Feels more Fourier series-y.
And let's see, I wouldn't want a kink either. So I'd also want, well, I guess if that's the case and it's nice and smooth, then the derivatives automatically would hook up too.
So that's, yeah, I don't have to worry about the derivative. If I,
is that true? I want it to be nice and smooth, so I guess suppose I'd want the derivatives to hook up too. But it turns out just that condition is going to give me Fourier series.
So it's kind of a fun exercise to do. I don't want kinks. So I would need to hook up the derivatives too, otherwise it would get it to be kinky solution.
I'm not going to go through the details, but when you solve that differential equation, my theta problem,
is, theta double prime, it was negative, so when I'd get a plus lambda theta here, and theta periodic.
When you do the negative case, you get hyperbolic sines and hyperbolic cosines, and they're not periodic. There's no way you can make them hook up at minus pi and pi. So, and also, let's see, what about the theta equals zero case? The theta equals zero case, it could be constant. Right?
So the theta negative case, those are hyperbolic functions, trig functions. Hyperbolic sine and cosine, no way. You can't make them hook up and be nice and periodic. So you don't get any solutions there. The lambda equals zero case, you get theta of theta is A theta plus B.
To make it hook up, you need the A to be zero.
And so you do get a constant solution. I need A equals zero, otherwise they don't hook up. And I get a constant solution. B.
So I do get one with theta equals zero.
And then to get the other ones,
to make them hook up, you need it. It's very similar to what we had before. The zeros would have to come back and hook up. And hook up at pi. And you're going to find out that you get solutions. Let's see, lambda less, bigger than zero.
You need sine nx, n theta rather, and cosine n theta. They're the only ones that come back and hook up.
If that n is wrong, it just doesn't happen.
And you have to mess around to show that. I don't want to do that in class today. I've done enough messing around like that. And so you get non-zero solutions. Exactly when lambda equals n squared. Where n is, n equal 1, 2, 3, etc.
So how that's exciting. The theta problem pins down my lambdas, and now I got to go back and think about my R solutions.
So I get a bunch of thetas. Let's see, I'll get a theta 0. Which is just the function 1, and I'll get theta n's equals an cosine n theta plus bn. Let's see, I should call this an a naught. It's a constant, a zero.
That's where the Fourier series are going to pop right out, like they have been every time. But it's r function that's going to be different than something we've seen before. So what about r? Let's do the case. So I need to find the rn's. Let's do the case n equals 0.
Then my problem was, what was it? R squared r double prime plus r prime over r equals 0. And so that r cancels out, and I'm left with r squared r double prime plus r prime equals 0.
That is a first order differential equation in disguise.
Let's see. Let's let u be equal to r prime. Or no, I've got to let v. I can divide by an r and get, this would be, I'll divide by r squared, I get r double prime plus 1 over r prime equals 0. And I'm going to change to v's, I'll get dv v prime plus 1 over rv equals 0.
That's a first order linear differential equation.
And that's an easy kind to solve. You learn how to solve it in 262 or someplace. First order linear. See, I'm going to run out of time, aren't I? Darn. Maybe that's good. So I'll finish today by solving this. Let's see, the integrating factor would be e to the integral of 1 over r dr. And that would be e to the log r. And of course, that's just r. So when I multiply this thing by the integrating factor, I'd get rv prime plus 1 over rv is 0. And let's see, this always turns out to be the derivative d by dr of the integrating factor times v.
And sure enough, it is. You can verify that.
Which means that r times v is a constant. And therefore, v is equal to constant, let's call it c1, over r. And remember, v was r prime. And so when you integrate that, you get r of r, r0 of r, is going to be c1 log r plus r, and plus c2.
Well, this is a heat problem, and the thing can't get hotter than hell at the origin, or colder than hell. This goes to minus infinity. So this thing is not physically meaningful.
That c1 must be 0. So, ouch.
That's not physically meaningful. The temperature doesn't plummet and go to minus infinity at the origin. And so that C1 must be 0. And I get my constant solution.
And that is a good place to call it quits for today. And I'll do the other case next time and finish this off.
Wait, isn't the differential equation we did on our homework, correct?
What? That's the same one you did in your homework, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to do it from the point of view of an Euler equation next time. So you'll see it two different ways.
If f and g are 2 pi periodic, is the convolution 2 pi periodic?
Yeah. I mean, there's multiple definitions of convolution. I don't think about that. Which definition of convolution?